on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring National POW MIA Day by listening to three different ex-prisoners of war. We heard from Bataan Death March survivor Wild Bill Begley. Now we turn to Julio Barella, a man I had the privilege of interviewing in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico in 2010. By the way, there were more men from New Mexico on the Bataan Death March than from any other state. If you go to Las Cruces, the only federally funded memorial to the Bataan Death March is a beautiful site in a park there. It has a statue of two men helping another, and in front and behind it, footsteps in the concrete. Some are shoes, some are bare feet, and those bare footprints are the actual footprints of men who survived the Bataan Death March. It's a must-see if you ever end up in the Las Cruces, El Paso area. As for Julio, at the age of 16, he had left his family farm north of Las Cruces to go to California and enlist in the Navy. Problem was, Mama was not so happy about that. His mother went out there, told him that he was underage, and then brought him back to the farm. But in May of 1941, there was nothing she could do about it. Julio was 22 then, and he was drafted into the Army.
We were supposed to serve 1 year. And then when we got there, they increased. It was 18 months. And after the 18 months, it was for all the duration of war. I spent in the Philippines and Japan almost 5.5 years.
Right, because you were there in the Philippines before the war started. And, of course, you weren't liberated in Japan till after the war ended. I read that all your equipment hadn't even been unpacked when the Japanese attacked. And I understand whatever equipment and supplies you did have wasn't anywhere near what you needed.
And we didn't have enough to fight with to begin with. So we did what we could until we ran out of everything. We ran out of food, too, so we ran out of ammunition. We didn't have any ammunition to fight, so we were forced to surrender. That was in Bataan.
And that was in April of 1942, 5 months after the war had started. And I'd like for you to shed a little light on those 5 months between being attacked at Clark Field and when the march started. Now, the unit you were with, everybody from New Mexico, and you were chosen especially because so many of you spoke Spanish, which they thought might come in handy in the Philippines. That was the 200th Coast Artillery, right?
200th Coast Artillery.
What kind of things were you expected to do? What were your duties?
Well, it was 3-inch gun and 5-inch guns. And we had searchlights, power plants. We buried the power plant in order to get electricity to run the control stations.
But an artillery unit isn't much good when you run out of ammunition, huh?
Well, we run out of everything because we didn't have any way of fighting.
When you heard that you guys were being surrendered to the Japanese, what went through your mind? How did that make you feel, and what were you thinking?
The reason was this. They still called us the Death March. Well, they named the Death March, the Japanese named the Death March, because, you know, we didn't surrender when we were told. We were told at the very beginning of the war to surrender, and we didn't surrender. We tried to fight them. So we didn't surrender until we ran out of everything. We were starving, eating weeds and stuff like that in order to survive, and there's where the Death March started.
Now, when you started that march, you had no idea how long it was going to go, and you're already starving, right?
We were pretty weak then because when we were fighting, we didn't have enough to eat. First thing, we were getting only 2 meals a day, and then they cut us to 1 meal a day. And then after that, we didn't have anything to eat.
What kept you going? How did you continue on? Because I'm sure a lot of guys were falling by the side and probably getting shot or bayoneted, and you were seeing guys fall left and right. What kept you going? How do you think you survived?
Well, we used to hunt. We used to eat weeds and stuff like that. Then a lot of them died with malaria, and a lot of them with diarrhea, according to what they eat. See, a lot of them died in the Death March, and then the other part died in concentration camp.
Did you ever think that you were going to die?
I thought I was going to die, but I just got to where I didn't care. I used to worry a lot about my folks, about my mother. I used to worry every day. And one day I said to myself, "Why, hell, I'm nothing but a doggone stupid. I'm not going to worry about them because they're better off than I am. They're not having as much trouble as I am." We got to where we forgot all about our folks and about the living life. Maybe we were just lucky because when they surrendered, a lot of them died of starvation. A lot of them, they didn't have anything to eat. They were weak, malaria, dysentery, and all that. A lot of disease. Well, we got to where we didn't care. We used to help the ones that couldn't walk by the Japanese. The ones that couldn't walk, they shoot them. When a man lay down and he can't get up, why, they shoot him. So if they were punish you when you were in concentration camp, they punished me and they knocked me down. And then I have in mind that if I try to stand up and get up, I won't be killed. That's a lesson the hard way.
I'll say that's a great way to put it, learning the hard way indeed. And every survivor of the Death March that I've interviewed over the years has told me really the same thing that you just did. No one knows exactly how many people died on the march. I've seen estimates of around 10,000 or so. And who knows how many died later because of what they went through on the march. But I know that you Americans helped each other, and you got a lot of help from the Filipinos, who, from what I've seen, statistically outnumbered Americans on the march about 7-1. But all of you were not only marching 61 miles through deep layers of dust, you really didn't have any kind of nourishment. How bad was it? How bad in terms of what you had to eat and drink?
They make us wait 3 days before they could start giving us a bowl of rice, just how much they can grab on a bowl of rice. Then in concentration camps, we were there starving all the time that we were in prison camp. We never did get anything much to eat. And they were Filipinos. They would try to help us, give us food. They find out that Filipino tried to help POWs. They would shoot them, burn their kids, burn their homes. They act like they were not civilized. We never have a dream that we was going to survive. We never thought we was going to make it.
Do you remember how much you weighed before?
I weighed about 145, 150. I never been very heavy. But when I was liberated, I weighed 83 pounds.
Skin and bones, huh?
Yeah.
And in addition to starving to death, you really had to live in constant fear of death. I really don't want to fan any kind of flames of anger or resentment or anything like that. But I want to understand, and I think our listeners want to understand, you weren't just starving to death. You had reason to believe that you could be shot, you could be bayoneted, beheaded even, for something that not even that you did, but that one of your fellow prisoners did.
Oh, I tell you this, but you probably won't believe.
I'll believe you.
But you know, a lot of the prisoners of war tried to escape, and that escaped made the Japs decide to divide the group in tens. So if one of them ten survive, the other dying, they will kill them. And they kill a lot of Americans. People don't believe. Just the only people that believe, the people that saw that, the Filipinos. The Filipinos, they know that. They did that. They line them up and they shoot nine. I saw them with my eyes.
So they would execute the other nine prisoners in a group of ten because of the one who tried to escape. I know it was truly a horrific experience, and I know it's not easy for you to talk about. So let's move on to a more pleasant topic, if you will. Your liberation. You survived the march to Camp O'Donnell. You'd been in another infamous camp at Cabanatuan. They took you over to Japan on a hell ship, and in late August of 1945, the atomic bombs had been dropped, the war was coming to an end, and finally, your camp at Niigata, Japan, was liberated. What do you remember about that? What do you remember about tasting freedom again for the first time in more than 3.5 years?
We're very, very weak. Our mind was very weak, and our bodies we couldn't hardly do much work. We just hope and pray that someday the war will be over. We were working in a foundry. They never gave us a day off, so we noticed that it was a surprise to us that the Japanese said that we were going to get 3 days off, that we have to stay in camp. So we were anxious to hear the Japanese commander telling us that we have surrendered. And the American officer asked the Japanese, what happened? Nothing. You people won the war. The war is over. Now you people take over tonight. What the Japanese told the American commander, you take care of your prisoners, not to go out because they're going to get killed, because the Japanese don't like the American prisoners, and they're going to get killed if they go out of the camp. So better stay in the camp, so we stay there, you know, until the next day. Then the next day, they go three planes, and they drop us leaflets saying that if we would clear the area, they will drop packages.
So they dropped some leaflets. They said, get out of the way. We don't want to kill you with the food we want to drop for you. And then you finally got to go outside of the walls of that camp. You'd been living in, I would imagine, and you've described what would be a bleak, seemingly hopeless world for so long, only praying that you'd make it out alive. So not to be too cliched, but did it feel like a dream come true or a prayer answered when you got to come home? What did that feel like?
Well, we had plenty to eat. Every place we go, we just give us something to eat and stuff like that. And it was pretty hard to tell the whole story about it. And I don't know. And some people, the prisoners of war I have talked to, they feel the same way that I feel. They didn't want to talk about it. They got to where they want to talk about it. That's funny. We do more talking now than we did before. We never did say anything because everywhere we go, we start asking us, do you have any Japanese that we killed and all that? None.
How often do you think about the other prisoners of war who didn't get to come home? Do you ever think about that, about all the guys who died over there?
I dream more about them than I dream about my people, even today. Every day I remember about some of the prisoners.
Do you ever think that could have been you? Do you ever think about how you could have died there?
Yeah, surprises me that I made it. I sometimes don't even believe it. Being so long and I've getting old and all that, I sometimes don't believe it. I made it. I don't believe it. I went through all that.
Why do you think it's important that people understand what happened to you and what happened to all those other prisoners?
It's something that I haven't seen before, and I don't think they'll ever see that again. For some people, it's unbelievable. This is what I have in mind. I hope the people, the modern people, will know what Japan did. Keep that in mind, what the Germans did. Keep that in mind.
I guess when you take everything into consideration, you'd have to say you beat some pretty significant odds to be sitting with me right now and talking about it.
Very few prisoners came back. A good number died after they arrived in the United States. They were not in good health, and they died. But I guess I was lucky.
Wow. You gaining some perspective today? He said he was lucky, but how fortunate are we that we haven't been through anything like what you've heard now from two different survivors of the Bataan Death March. When we come back, we're going to hear about a different march that took place later in the war in different conditions. The rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live. live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.